The date is July 4th, 1990, and we're watching Die Hard 2. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Merry Christmas!
Oh, and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Major Grant to my Colonel Stewart.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart. I probably should have asked before we started recording whether or not we were going to go with Die Hard 2 or Die Harder.
Oh shit, I didn't even listen to what you did in the opening.
I went Die Hard 2.
Oh, see, everywhere in my notes, it's Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Die Harder, yeah.
Like, you gotta have them both. I mean, it is interesting that this is the only Die Hard film that actually has a number until Disney Plus went and rebranded them all, like, Die Hard 4.0 instead of Live Free and Die Hard. They went and rebranded them all with numbers, but until Disney did that, this was the only one that actually had a number in its title, but I always know it as Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Hmm.
Yeah, and after your compliments back when we did Ghostbusters of me not just going for the giving you the black guy in my intro, I mean, I was looking through this, and it's kind of like, well, are you the Al Powell to my John McClane? Are you the Leslie Barnes to my Ed Trudeau? I mean, yeah, the only way I could have changed it up is if I had taken the Major Grant and given you Colonel Stewart.
I thought we were going to go with Al again, but we switched it up. That's okay.
Well, because he only gets one scene in this movie.
but what a scene it is.
Yes, and fourth credited in this movie. I'm getting way ahead of myself. I haven't even introduced the fact that we have a special guest this week because way back last year when we covered Die Hard 1 on this show, we had a young man who had never seen that movie before, and we said we need to make it a Christmas tradition to have him on the show watching a Die Hard movie. And so we live up to our word, and so please welcome back Mr. Jack Bazook.
Hello!
Hello! Oh my god, so excited to have you back for Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
that's gonna become a huge mouthful. I feel like we just need to say Die Harder.
Yeah. And as we promised, it is another Christmas movie for you, Jack, is it not? Did we lie to you?
Definitely a Christmas movie.
Yeah. I mean, if we do make this an annual tradition and have you back next Christmas, we've got Die Hard with a Vengeance is the next one, but that's not a Christmas movie. But it's like, do we care more about the integrity of Christmas or care more about the integrity of having Jack watching a Die Hard movie? It's which is the better tradition? I don't know. So this week, we are looking back at July 1990 when the movies in theaters were RoboCop 2, Days of Thunder, Gremlins 2, The New Batch, Another 48 Hours... And I've got a bonus one here because I love the title and it's a movie I've actually seen, I'm sad to admit, a movie called Frankenhooker.
Oh my gosh. Please explain what the premise of Frankenhooker is for the fans.
Well, if you can imagine a Frankenstein movie where it's made up of stripper parts, that's Frankenhooker.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's a B movie. It's terrible. It's not a porn like you would think maybe it might be with my description of that movie. But there is definitely a lot of zombie Frankenstein boob going on. But yes, at the same time as Frankenhooker is, of course, our movie for today, Die Hard 2, Die Harder, which earned $240.2 million on a $70 million budget.
And as always, we will be having heavy spoilers in this movie, so if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you, please hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
That's right, we're going to spoil it hard, or maybe even harder.
Yeah, spoil harder. Spoil hard with a vengeance.
A good day to spoil hard.
Yeah, there you go.
So, the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, oh, I have several once again, but the first one, we've already said it. First one is Die Harder. So, I don't know whether it was like Die Hard 2, Die Harder, and then the tagline was also Die Harder. I don't know whether, you know, they made Die Harder just the tagline, because I don't know the story behind, like, that one, but...
Yeah, I was going to say Die Harder sounds like a good tagline. When I heard that that was an actual name for the movie, I always thought that was just a joke. Like, yeah. I swear that's a joke in Family Guy or something, that then somehow it's like they manifested it into reality.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could do that with almost any sequel. You know, it could be American Pie 2, Pie Harder. You know, I don't know. It's... Number two tagline. They say lightning never strikes twice. They were wrong.
Okay.
See, I mean, I feel lightning strikes twice, just never in the same place twice. And he's not in the same place anyway, so I don't know. I think it's easy for lightning to strike twice. Number three, John McClane, terrorists in an airport. Nothing can go wrong this time. This is an audio format, Jack. I mean, I love the faces that you're making, but man, feel free to say something way in here, because your face is saying a lot to me.
It just sounds like a bad, like something you'd see in a strip mall on the side of the highway.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what could go wrong here? Like,
for like car insurance or something? I don't know. Yeah, okay. Next one, this is a callback to our first episode. Last time, it blew you through the back wall of the theater. This time, it will blow you sky high.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's kind of clever, I guess.
Yeah, that's what it's saying, like, airplanes or something.
Yeah, airplanes.
But...
The airplane connection.
Exactly. The ejection seat as well, right? He gets blown sky high literally at one point. Yeah. Next tagline, yippee-ki-yay all over again.
That's a good one. I like that one. That one. Okay. If I had to pick one, that would be it.
Yeah. Well, wait, there's two more. Next up, I hate it when I'm right.
That's good. I like that one.
Yeah. But, I mean, first person on a poster, I don't know, right?
Yes. I mean, yeah, it's not, you won't get it until you watch the movie, so is it really drawing the people in?
That's true. Yeah,
you'd want to take the poster of Bruce Willis and, like, put a speech balloon with that tagline in it. I hate it when I'm right. And finally, look who's back in the wrong place at the right time.
That was pretty good. That was pretty good, too.
Are you still all in on yippee-ki-yay all over again?
I think that one's the funnest one, and that one, like, draws you in.
Yeah, because if you've seen the first one, you know about the yippee-ki-yay line. So
Okay. Well, it may not be the best description of this movie, so let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
All right, this one is basically fresh off the presses because I just wrote it today. Hopefully that doesn't show. It's Christmas Eve, and former NYPD, now LAPD officer John McClane, 2 years removed from his escapades in Nakatomi Tower, finds himself once more trying to save his wife from terrorists. However, this time they are of the homegrown American-made variety. While waiting for Holly's plane to come into Dulles International Airport, keen-eyed John observes some strange and obviously criminal behavior. After failing to arouse the concerns of the local police, John takes matters into his own hands and tries to stop Colonel William Stewart and his band of ex-US military terrorists who seek to liberate detained drug lord General Ramon Esperanza by taking over control of the airport and holding the passengers in the air hostage. Will John be able to kill anyone with less than 10 shots fired at a time? Will his hero status be enough for local authorities to once more overlook his lack of jurisdiction? Does Colonel Stewart always do martial arts in the nude? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Oh, that one got a big reaction from Jack. We'll get there in a minute, Jack. You've been working on your R rolls a little bit there. Good effort. I mean, you're not quite there, but good effort. I mean, I know you mentioned a couple weeks ago that your R rolls aren't that good, but
yeah, it's not something that comes natural to me, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, Jack, we discussed last year you had never seen Die Hard, and I said, well, you know, if you're going to watch a movie with your uncle, you should watch Die Hard 2, because it's also a Christmas movie, and then you get to complete it. Did you watch it last Christmas, or was this a first-time viewing for you this year?
No, this was a first-time viewing. I watched it. I did end up watching it with an uncle.
Okay.
My two uncles here in Ontario, actually. But it was first time watching it.
Okay, and... like I said last year, why the hell not? Why haven't you seen this movie, Jack?
I mean, I don't even know. It's just not on my radar, right? Like, yeah. At this point, it's like 30 years old, and
it came out like, when were you born again? I'm guessing this movie is like 10 years older than you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm 20 this year, and this movie came out in 1990, and that's a little bit.
Okay, fair enough. Colin, what about you? What's your history with Die Hard 2, Die Harder? I'm going to be giving it its full proper name as much as I can this entire episode.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I have less excuses. I was born when this movie came out, but I have still only seen it once before this viewing, and it was probably like about 10 years ago.
Okay.
As people have clearly discerned by listening to this podcast, I have a lack of knowledge of 80s and early 90s movies. So probably around 10 years ago, I went through like all the Rocky movies. I watched Forrest Gump for the first time, which is embarrassing. I watched, and then Die Hard was included in that. And I think at that time there was only the three of them, maybe.
Yeah,
three.
Probably 10 years ago. Only three at that point.
Yeah. So I just watched the trilogy, as it were, then.
Yeah. Have you seen the other two at all?
Actually haven't. No, I haven't seen the newer ones, mostly because like Bruce Willis kind of reached this point in his career where he just felt a little sad to me. Like he was kind of a sad watch.
He's always just playing Bruce Willis too.
Yeah. And he's not playing. Yeah. Like when you watch, that was kind of one of the interesting things about watching this movie and even watching Die Hard is like, I would have always thought before that Bruce Willis was John McClane, but I don't think that's true anymore. I actually think there is Bruce Willis, and then there's Bruce Willis playing John McClane. Like, they're not, like, the same guy. But, yeah, Bruce Willis kind of fell into Nicolas Cage territory, where it's just like, oh, Bruce Willis is in this movie, and he's Bruce Willis.
It's just, yeah, it's the recognition of the name, rather than a character he can portray.
Yeah, it's a quick paycheck, come in, do 5 days of work. Yeah, I mean, because, like, Bruce Willis definitely went through a renaissance around the time that, you know, the second and third movie were coming out. I mean, that's when he was doing movies like 12 Monkeys and Sixth Sense and Pulp Fiction. And he was a really exciting, like, versatile actor. And then, yeah, at one point, as soon as he just always had his head shaved, it was just...
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. The minute he lost all his hair like Samson, it's like he just lost all his power.
Because like Death Becomes Her and Sixth Sense, that's Bruce Willis with hair, you know, and, you know, so he's still doing some interesting stuff. And then like it just, yeah, he shaved it and he never looked back. And you get stories like Kevin Smith saying how he'll never work with him again and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, let's jump into Die Hard 2, Die Harder. In Russian, this series is known as a hard nut to crack, I found out. In Spanish, it's the glass jungle, and in Polish, the glass trap is what the Die Hard films are referred to as. The glass ones all have to do with the first movie, you know, the whole Nakatomi Plaza thing. Mm-hmm. So,
it just... you think the tagline for the glass ones was glass harder? Like, glass, like trappier?
He's a real pain in the glass.
Yeah. What a hard glass.
This is some hard glass to crack. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So it's directed by Rennie Harlan, but I read that John McTiernan was going to come back to direct, but was already committed to The Hunt for Red October. But Rennie Harlan is someone that's done like Cliffhanger, Driven, Deep Blue Sea, Action Guy, produced by Charles and Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver, and written by Stephen E. D'Souza, Doug Richardson, Walter Wager, it's based on his novel 58 Minutes, and Roderick Thorpe, who once again, just like the first movie, gets the highly specific credit of certain characters created by. I find it interesting, though, that it's like the first one was based on a book, this one's based on a different book, but you still have to credit the first author because of the first movie. It's just, it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Nothing Lasts Forever, which is what the first movie is based on, I have never read 58 Minutes, so I don't know what that's like. So we open this movie on John McClane's car being towed, including a quick exposition dump update about his life, then a shot of a television telling the terrorist plot for the movie. I mean, right there in the first 5 minutes, it just gives you all the pieces that you're going to need to put this movie together. And then we see, and I can't wait to hear what Jack has to say about that expression that he gave me. We get to see William Sadler naked doing Tai Chi.
The movie's not even like, you're not even 5 minutes into this movie, and all of a sudden you get like dark room man nude, just like
sweaty
standing
man
there, yeah, standing there sort of menacingly, and he's doing these like really slow movements, and you're like, why is he naked?
Yeah,
like, I just have just no reason for it, like, whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting though is I read that the script said that there was a quote, a half naked man seen doing Tai Chi.
That was my big question. My big question watching the scene was, is this in the script or is this a character choice?
No, yeah, it was the director's choice to make him nude. And when William Sadler found this out, he's like, dude, you got to give me time to know about this. And so they pushed this scene to the end of the shoot schedule so that William Sadler had time to tone up a bit more for this nude scene. And I thought that was absolutely hilarious when I found that out, because he's like, I was only expecting to be half naked.
Yeah.
He's the only working chest, and then he goes, oh no, my thighs. Yeah, yeah.
I was gonna say his thighs are very large, so maybe he needed to even things out.
Yeah, he was skipping leg day too much, and then he overdid it.
I found that scene so needlessly aggressive, but then I thought,
even how he turns off the TV?
Yeah.
he spins around and is like, click.
Yeah. Because I guess, like, the big question with the villain is, how are you going to top Alan Rickman? Like, how are you going to top Hans Gruber? And so I guess they kind of had to go the opposite way and just have this guy who just, like, Gruber seemed more, like, cerebral, yeah. But Stewart is like, he's calls himself later, he's the main event, so like, he's very, he's a lot more physical.
No, and I also like seeing him so soon after doing Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, whereas he's so lovable as death. But...
Holy shit, I didn't even put that together. That's the same guy.
No wonder you didn't recognize him in the other scene in Bogus Journey. Okay, yeah, no, this is Death. This is the same guy in that movie. Yeah.
Wow.
So... He's a chameleon. You put a bald cap on him and he's a chameleon.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey was, like, the next year. And, I mean, I don't know. I guess all the fitness that he did in this movie, I'm surprised we didn't get a shirtless death scene in Bill and Ted's.
Yeah, they could have had a wrestling match when they played the games instead of playing Battleship.
Yeah.
That probably would have done a lot better.
Greco-Roman wrestling.
Yeah. Part of this opening scene that I really love is the fact that, like, John McClane is just, like, the consummate police officer. You know, like, he's just sitting around, just eyeing everybody up, like, looking for clues, looking for any sign of trouble. He's almost like Jason Bourne.
Yeah,
he's like scoping the joint, like, as he's, like, sitting there waiting for his wife's plane to land.
Yeah, but, I mean, you have to admit, like, the terrorists, when you actually see them walking around with the presence and everything like that, they are not inconspicuous at all. In fact, they are completely spicuous. I mean, or conspicuous. Is conspicuous a word? I don't know whether, but they are not being at all subtle. I mean, the way they're all marching down the hallway. And sure, there's no one there.
That nice, like, choreographed exit from all the doors.
Yeah.
From the hotel rooms. Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't look like a problem.
No. It's like casually. They're all holding nice big presents too, like all wrapped the same.
Yeah. But it also shows that it's very much like a product of its time as well. Because part of the reason they stand out in that little bar area to John McClane is because one of them has an earpiece on. And it's like, you would not think twice about someone talking on an earpiece these days. You know, like, not suspicious at all.
Headphones are earpieces now. Like, the AirPods and everything, that's just two earpieces at this point.
Yeah. I know, it's so much easier to be, like, a terrorist or something nowadays.
This movie is kind of like a time capsule movie for me, in that, you know, even when he first goes into the airport after his car gets towed, and he goes to where all the payphones are, and it's this massive mob of people waiting
because
for a payphone.
Paged.
And then because he's being paged, which is like, I barely even know what a pager is. Jack's a pager might as well be in a museum to Jack.
Yeah, exactly.
or a fax machine. Or the fact that later on, like, he just fully lights up a cigarette in the middle of an airport in, like, an indoor public space.
Well, I also like when he phones back the number and says, I don't know who you are, and he calls it. And it's like, oh, shit, aren't you on a plane? How are you calling me? You know, it's called an airphone. Wake up and smell the 90s, John.
Yeah. Like, that's the funniest line. Wake up and smell the 90s.
Yeah. Man.
That's so good.
Well, and my favorite is also on the airplane, the fact that that little old lady has a taser.
Yeah.
It's like, really? You got a taser through security? Like,
or 2001, everything could go on the planes.
Yeah. Oh my god, yeah. That just...
Well, see, it's kind of crazy because later on, John is... Like, she got a taser on the plane, but later on, John is talking about how they have ceramic handguns that are, like, untraceable by...
Can't get through... Yeah, the airport security doesn't pick them up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, something I read was the fact that those guns do not exist. There is no Glock that is undetectable by a metal detector, but it's a line that the filmmakers insisted on keeping in, even though it was, like, proved wrong, because, you know, yeah, it's more than you make in a year. You'd be surprised what I make in a year. Oh, man, I love this movie. I guess I didn't say that up at the top. I mean, I am a diehard fan until the end of 3, and then it drops off for me, but I do love the first 3 Die Hards so much, with a vengeance even.
There's some
the one thing I will say about Die Hard is it holds its weight in good solid one-liners. Like, probably my favorite one that is when he's talking to the, like, airport police chief or whatever, I can't remember his name, and he says, like, what does he say? It's like when you go through the metal detectors, like, what sets it off first? And he's like, it's like the lead in your ass or the shit in your brains.
Yeah, that's the one.
So good.
Yeah, and that one always bugs me too, because it's like, shit wouldn't set off a metal detector.
Yeah.
Makes no sense.
Well, Colin, I love that you brought up that scene, because I think it's time to do a little I used to like this One Piece theater.
Oh, wow. So soon.
So soon. Well, you brought it up, and as a coincidence, I happened to pick out the script from that particular scene because I had so much fun last year with Jack doing I Used to Like This One Piece Theater and his take on John McClane.
Oh, God.
That I decided I wanted to have Jack reprise his role as John McClane. I mean, you know, we gave... Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey a couple of weeks ago, we gave it a huge compliments for, like, going outside of the box. But, I mean, this is just the first movie in an airport. So, if we're going to repeat the storyline almost beat for beat, we have to repeat our last episode almost beat for beat and have Jack do another I Used to Like This One Piece Theater. So, I have just sent you guys both the scripts for this scene. Jack, I will get you to play John McClane once again, and Colin, we're going to let you play Carmine Lorenzo. Alrighty, so whenever you guys are ready, let's do this. Let's die harder.
All right. Are you ready, Jack?
I'm prepared as much as I can be.
McClane?
Lorenzo?
Captain Lorenzo.
Well, I'm the one who...
Yeah, I know. You think that L.A. badge is going to get you a free lunch or something down here?
No, just a little professional courtesy.
In an airport? Christmas week? You gotta be kidding.
Okay, forget the courtesy. How about just profession? The boys just walked away from a crime scene. You need to seal it off. Get a forensics team in. Dust it. Shoot it.
And what do we do with all the luggage for all the airplanes we play, Charlie Chan?
You store them somewhere.
Oh, and meanwhile, every hour a few more thousand people come and they want to put their luggage on airplanes, so we store them under their luggage in some other somewhere? Hell, why don't we shut down the whole fucking airport? What do you think they'll say upstairs when I tell them that?
Well, why don't you try and find out?
Because I don't need a forensics investigation to file away some punk stealing luggage.
Luggage? That punk pulled a Glock 7 on me. You know what that is? A porcelain gun from Germany. It doesn't show up on an airport x-ray machine. And it costs more than you earn in a month.
You'd be surprised what I earn in a month.
If it's more than $1.89, yeah.
McLean! Don't start believing your own press. Yeah, I know who you are. That Nakatomi thing in L.A. Just because the TV thought you were hot shit, don't make it so. This time you're in my little pond, and I'm the big fish that runs it. Now you cap some lowlife. Fine. I'll send your fucking captain in L.A. a fucking commendation. Now get the hell out of my office before I have you thrown out of my airport.
One question, Carmine. What sets off a metal detector first? The shit in your brains or the lead in your ass?
Yes! I used to like this One Piece theater.
Whew! Things got heavy.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I know we usually go several weeks between I used to like this One Piece theaters, but it's the holiday season. This is our Christmas episode, so I figured, you know, we gotta give the people a little extra special gift this holiday season. So there we go.
That was a good scene to do, I think, if we're gonna do one from this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple others I considered, like them arguing in the tower, but then I realized, oh, wait, there's four people in that scene. So I'm like,
no,
yeah.
You know what?
I'll let Jack and Colin have this one again. And this time we don't have to make Colin do an accent.
All right, yeah.
There we go. We've just introduced Captain Carmine Lorenzo. Jack, what did you think of this foil for John McClane in this movie?
I liked him. He was funny, right? Like, he was this sort of idiot, sort of cop, sort of, like, idea where he's like, no, I'm the captain here. This is my thing, and I know what I'm doing. And McClane's like, no, you don't. I know what I'm doing. Can you please listen to me? And he's like, no, I have all the authority. You listen to me.
Yeah.
And it was a good little, like, until the switch later in the movie when he realized that McClane was right and started helping.
Yeah,
it was fun. It was fun to do that back and forth. The, like, I'm mad at you. No, you're mad at me. And, you know, it was good.
I liked the tie-in at the end when you find out that the like traffic cop or whatever.
It's
his brother or his cousin or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing I do love is, like, you know, we've got the scene where John McClane is following his hunch and he goes and he tells the one guy to let, you know, you got a key for this place? Let me in, right? And then go get airport police. And I love the look on that guy's face when John McClane says, go get airport police. It's almost like the actor himself was like, where am I supposed to go now?
Like, yeah, that poor guy. He just was like, I mean, John McClane is so condescending, but he weirdly, it's always like there's always a black guy that comes to his aid in these movies. I feel like,
yeah,
like first it's this guy, and then later it's that other
with the Barnes. With the nice part.
Barnes, yeah. Yeah,
he's got a nice part.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but we also can't forget Marvin. I mean, he's got a lot of little sidekicks in this movie. Marvin, the weirdo in the basement. Who is Marvin?
He's a janitor. He cleans stuff, I guess. I don't know. He's got all the plans to all the buildings.
Yeah, but is he, like, the only janitor for this airport? Because, like, why does he have his own special place in these tunnels underneath the airport?
He probably was a janitor, and then he got fired, but they let him. He probably, like, lives there.
I was going to say, I don't think he actually works for the airport. I think he's more like the Phantom of the Opera or the Rat King from Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, him and his nudie mag sit up in his office. He's got, like, a poster in his office.
Listening to records. And
records that he's probably stolen from people's luggage.
I wonder if Parasite stole their idea from Die Hard 2 then. They're like, wait a minute, that character in the basement is a good idea. Uh-oh, I'm getting blank looks. Have either of you seen Parasite?
No, sorry.
Oh, okay. Oh, shit. Well, we can, spoiler we can, alert we can, on...
We can talk about it in 30 years on this show. The one character who I didn't really get was the reporter.
Dick,
I didn't
up in the plane? Or the girl reporter?
No, the girl reporter, the one that okay, they, yeah. for whatever reason, like, Stewart's guys call her a pinko, and they're so aggressive, and they're like, yeah, we got two words, you can have two, fucking you.
Yeah, that was
a uncalled for.
I mean, I'm wondering what the story is with Colonel Stewart, because, like, they allude to it, but they don't ever actually give his backstory, do they?
I think they talk about it in one of, like...
Is it in there like was a newscast?
Yeah, there's a couple times on the second viewing where I realized that there is a lot of exposition given in the newscasts. And I think they kind of talk about him. They talk about like his like him being whatever they call it, dishonorable discharge or whatever.
Oh,
like
okay.
in one of those news stories, but it's just like a passing thing.
Like, I'm wondering, I mean, this may be a reference that's too old for both of you, but I'm wondering whether it's like an Oliver North type situation where that's where I'm wondering what the story is behind that, whether, yeah, okay. All, any older listeners might know what the Oliver, he was this guy that was put on trial or something for selling arms to one of America's enemies or, see, I don't even know the story that well, but like, I'm just wondering how high profile this Colonel Stewart. I should have introduced you as my Colonel Stewart after all. I just fucking realized that.
Well, yeah.
That was my thought right at the beginning. I was like, it's Colin Stewart. Should have been Colonel Stewart, but yeah. You know.
Anyway. But well, yeah, I
they do mention something about in the newscast, something about how Esperanza in his like drug trafficking or whatever has been linked to like US military officials. But yeah, okay. Now that I think about it, I don't think they actually mention Colonel Stewart, but it does seem like people clearly know who he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that reporter recognized him walking in the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's Colonel Stewart. Yeah.
And I like that when he bumps into John, he's just John's like, "You look familiar." And he's like, "Yes, I've been on TV."
Yeah, and John says, "Me too." Yeah. In the background of that scene where they bump into each other, Liev Schreiber is one of the extras in the background.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's got longer hair, but yeah, Liev Schreiber, Sabretooth himself from Wolverine. There we go.
Ray Donovan.
Yeah, Ray Donovan, absolutely. Or Cotton Weary from Scream. But yeah, apparently he's in the background there. I didn't notice him, but I read that. I'm going to look for that next time.
I want to talk about how every person in the freaking airport was allowed to get into the tower.
Yeah.
Because, like, I feel like the tower should be a closed-off space, and then all of a sudden John McClane just, like, goes up the elevator and is in the tower, and then 5 minutes later, the reporter lady goes up the elevator and is in the tower. Like, you'd think that they wouldn't be letting people into the tower.
Yeah, you'd think that would be locked off, like you'd need a special key of some sort.
Yeah,
that should be a secured location if that's where all your communication occurs. Like, realistically, the terrorists might not have known, but they could have just gotten the elevator and went up and took the whole place by force.
But I mean, yeah, that's true. Yeah, why'd they bring in all their own equipment? They could have just hijacked the equipment that's already there. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what airport security would have been like in the 90s, though, because, again, I will point out the fact that apparently you can get a taser onto the airplane.
I mean, yeah. That is kind of a wild thing about Die Hard, and especially, like, this movie, and then because the next one, I'm pretty sure that's where, like, there's the terrorists are attacking the World Trade Center, aren't they?
Well,
in Die Hard
not,
with a Vengeance?
No, not World Trade Center. They end up setting off a bomb on the subway system because they're robbing the Fort Knox of New York or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's planted all the bombs all around the city to distract John McClane, because apparently John McClane is the only competent cop that can stop fucking anybody.
Yeah,
it seems like a lot of terrorists keep attacking, and that like he's the only one who can do anything about it.
Wrong place at the right time. Lightning never strikes twice, buddy. Yeah.
I mean, I don't even want to say that. Never mind.
I'll say it, and if we all think it's too bad, then we can cut it out and it doesn't have to actually air. But I was like, you know how, like, in Inglourious Basterds, it's like an alternative telling of, like, World War II? Like, I would almost love to see a Tarantino version of Die Hard that was, like, John McClane on 9/11. John McClane is somehow, like, able to stop all the planes somehow.
Yeah, he's, like, on one of the planes and, like figures out the communication and, like, talks to the states and, like, figures it out or something.
Yeah, because that was, like, what I kept thinking about watching this movie was just, like, it's so now, like, retro obviously came out 10 year, 11 years earlier, but it's, like, I mean, it's so, like, resonant of 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of hijacking planes and using planes as hostages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because it really shows, like, just how vicious of a criminal Colonel Stewart is. He's absolutely heartless when he crashes that plane. And it's like, it's one of those. I mean, obviously the director goes in and he makes sure that we show the state of all the people on the plane so that it's that much more impactful. But you know, like just absolutely pouring it on. We're making sure that we're seeing the kid that's getting the teddy bear back and the little old woman, you know, don't worry, your grandson's waiting for you, or, you know, like, you know, let's have, like, a crate of puppies in the back. That's what we need. Let's kill off some puppies too. like it's so foreshadowing, or not, I guess foreshadowing's the wrong word. It's just so.
Mm-hmm. They're really setting you up.
Yeah. Don't worry. We radioed ahead. You'll make your next plane on time. You know, shit like that. Like.
And then even as he's walking through the wreckage and he finds, like, the doll.
Yeah.
Right. It's another one where you're like. Like, oh man, like, I really just watched a whole plane of people explode.
Yeah, and I saw the...
Explosions.
Sure. Which...
All of them. All the explosions. Both the plane explosions.
Yeah.
Because, all three of the plane explosions, because three of them explode. The whole point of the planes, right, is that they're flying around and they have no fuel. So when they land, like, they're running out of fuel, they have to land.
Yeah.
So when that one, like, it crashes into the ground, the explosion is, like, so after the fact. Like, the plane is crashed, it's scraping, and then all of a sudden, like, the wing is on fire, and then all of a sudden, the whole cabin has exploded. And, like, I mean, I know, like, aerospace engineer, but, like, I feel like that's not how planes, like, if they were going to blow up, they don't blow up like that.
Yeah, I feel like they would just, like, hit and blow.
Because it would hit the ground with such impact that it would explode, because I think it's because, like, plane gas is, like, you need so much more oxygen for it to burn that it doesn't burn as strongly as, like, gasoline from a car.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. I don't know. I just really noticed that, like, it was, like, little explosion into, okay, now the whole plane has been blown up completely. Like, there's nothing left. It's just wreckage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched enough Mythbusters over the year to know that there's, like, a very good percentage of gas to oxygen that is kind of the ideal situation for the perfect explosion. So maybe the fact that they are on fumes, as they say, you know, maybe it's just like, well, okay, you brought it down to the perfect mixture that a few sparks from this wing dragging on the ground is going to be enough to ignite it. I mean, yeah, it may have been a bit bigger than with the amount of fuel that they have left, but I still buy it.
I mean, the one I don't know is, like, the end one.
Where it goes up the trail of gas, goes up the wing.
I don't know if it would have stayed lit that long, like, enough to go. Like,
and then enough to park every plane coming down afterwards as well, like.
Yeah, you'd think that all the explosions and debris on the tarmac and everything, like, they would have had to clear all that off before they could land all the other planes.
Like 14 or 15 planes?
Yeah. I'm guessing Dulles is probably a fairly large airport, so maybe they had other spots, but...
In Washington, that would make sense.
Yeah, that would make sense. But yeah, I mean, I could go back to Mythbusters on that question about the gas, and I remember them trying to see if peeing on the third rail could actually electrocute you, and there would be too much
distance.
Like, gap. Yeah, I was like,
yeah, there's too much gaps between in the stream that you can't actually make a circuit like that. So I don't know whether that flame would travel up. Maybe it would, because it's not the same as electricity. I don't know. But I mean, I also find it interesting that he pulls the thing on it and it starts flooding the tarmac. And when he lights it, he's at the very end of the gas trail. But it's like,
so convenient.
He's like right there. And he's not covered in it at all.
That too. Yeah, yeah.
And there's this perfectly formed gas trench just in front of him.
It's like melted the snow away.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he would have pulled the thing, and then he would have fallen off. I mean, like, he still would have been beside the gas trail at the point that he fell off. But the line should go, like, another 100 yards behind him, because he would have traveled that much more distance before falling off the wing.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying. It's like, he's at the end of the trail for some reason.
Yeah. One of the scenes that I was thinking about was, the very first time when the terrorists take over that church. Like, for starters, I feel super bad for that guy who is living there. Like, he just gets capped with zero remorse and, like, just wrong place, wrong time. So sad.
Yeah.
But then, like, you're talking about electricity. So they're going to cut the electricity from this place, I guess, because it's close. But at one point, they take a chainsaw to what I can only assume is, like, a live power conduit.
Yeah.
Later they show them like slicing one with an axe, and I was like, well, maybe the axe, it's fast enough, it's got a wooden handle that they wouldn't get electrocuted, maybe,
yeah.
But the chainsaw, I don't know. I don't think you can just chainsaw through an electrical wire. I think that would end up poorly.
Yeah. Well, Colin, you just gave me another Christmas present because you just gave me another segue. That chainsaw, well, it's a Still brand chainsaw, and I think that means it's time for Sponsorship Corner!
Man, I'm just hitting them all over the place today.
Batting 1,000 for me today. So always on the lookout for product placements in movies this week. Die Hard 2, Die Harder is brought to you by Northeast, Windsor, and American Trans Airlines. The strange thing is that I was able to find all of these airlines as being like real airlines when I Googled them. However, later read that they were all fictional because no airline actually wanted to give their name to a movie involving a terrorist plot against airplanes. I don't know which to believe, so maybe they're fictional, maybe they're not. I found them online, though. Pacific Bell, Tiger Shark Golf Clubs, Tag Heuer Watches, Sanyo and Kenwood Electronics, Waltham Record Players, Sub-Zero Construction Company, Still Tools, Hostess Twinkies, Country Inns Magazine, Budget Rent-A-Car, and Ford, the Washington Redskins, the Simpsons, and the TV stations WNTW, which is real, and WZDC, which might not be real, and of course, the fictional Nakatomi Corporation. I'd also like to note that Black & Decker paid to have Bruce Willis use one of their cordless drills in this movie, but the scene was cut, and it resulted in Black & Decker suing 20th Century Fox in the first ever product placement lawsuit against a film.
Wow.
Yep. That's crazy.
$150,000 lawsuit that was filed out of court. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So yeah, I brought up Twinkies in there. Gotta give a shout out to our boy Al Powell, who, like I said at the top, fourth billing, but he's in one scene of this movie. I wish Reginald Val Johnson had been a bigger part of this movie. I always wanted to see the Al and John team up Die Hard, and he never comes back for another Die Hard.
Oh, really? That's unfortunate. Yeah. I agree. I think that would have been a better.
He could have been the guy movie. In the basement.
Yeah, he could have been there. Well, I think it'd just been, or like it would have been awesome if Al got captured somehow.
Like, yeah, true. Yeah, it wasn't his wife up on the plane. It was Al
up on the plane. Oh, I like that. I like that. That would have been nice. Well, okay, there we go. Let's talk about Holly for a moment here. Holly Gennaro McLean, played by Bonnie Bedelia. I'll make the joke again. Amelia Bedelia's sister. oh, come on, there's so many parallels in this movie. I have to make an identical joke. How can two things happen to one guy twice? I mean...
That sounds so generic. How can two things happen to the one guy twice?
Twice, yeah.
Well, but no, yeah. I do love some of the plane stuff, though. I mean, I really enjoy the fact that they had to throw Thornburg, but like the stewardess as well has some great moments in that whole relationship where she, what did you do? I knocked out two of his teeth. More champagne.
I felt like the plane was just kind of filler.
Yeah, I agree.
Like,
I was going to say filler, yeah.
Like, I think you could cut all those scenes and just occasionally just pan to a scene with no dialogue of just Holly, like, on the plane, worried on the plane, and the movie plays just as well. Like, they tried to make something between her and that reporter, but, like...
Thornburg, yeah.
But, like, was I missing something? Did something happen between them in the last movie? Is that what they're referencing, or...
Yeah, she punched him out at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was there, like, being rude at the party, like, the whole night.
Okay. No. Yeah, no. I didn't remember him at all from the original one, so yeah, I was lost.
He's the one that went to interview her kids at the door. Not, yeah, you're thinking Ellis, Jack. You're thinking the guy, the cocaine guy.
The boss. That's the boss at the party.
Yeah, the reporter was the one that
went to her house.
Threatened the maid with immigration.
And yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and so she punched him out at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. I just, okay. So the restraining order too, where it's like,
yeah,
he has one against me.
But okay, what I don't understand though about like Thornburg getting taken to his seat and then just realizing that Holly is there. Where was he being taken from? Like, did he try to sneak into a first class seat or something? Like,
I think that was the idea, was that he was getting pulled back from first class because they didn't have enough seats. And he was like, but I was on a first class seat and I want the first class meal. My company paid for it and all this, all that.
But they were already in the air. So what, did he go try to make a stink of it halfway through the flight?
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, that's one thing I've never understood about this. It's like, well, okay, if this scene happened at the beginning of the flight before they took off, then I'd understand it. But in mid-flight, like, he didn't raise the stink before? I don't know. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah, I didn't get anything about what was going on in that plane. The stewardesses did have some funny moments, but...
And the little old lady.
Yeah,
with her, like, I like that they had real glasses, too, like, for the champagne, like, they got, like, actual glass on the plane.
Yeah, in a post-9/11 world, yeah, I don't think that happens, because you could make a shiv out of it or something.
Yeah. I thought it was odd, too, that he had, like, a man further back on the plane. Like, was that his, like, camera guy or something?
Yeah, I think so.
And then, yeah, because the guy just, like, happened to have a radio receiver, like, in his bag.
Yeah.
And then, like...
Don't you?
Yeah, obviously. You know, I carry one with me all the time. I'm always on the CB.
Yeah. So what would you have done differently, Colin, then, instead of having the Thornbird story? Like, would you have made the other reporter crack the story? Because you got to have that story to give the panic in the airport and everything.
Yeah, I probably would have made, had that report. Because I also feel like she's kind of left a little bit with nothing really substantial to do. So, I mean, it would have been, she could have easily just broke the story and then had just kind of, like I said, like, I think part of the idea of having the plane is because, I mean...
You want the helicopter. That's why you have the other reporter, I mean, is because of the helicopter, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, not because the plane,
Yeah, with the plane, I'm like, I don't know if it was an equality thing, but I imagine, like, the woman who plays Holly, like, she kind of... If she's gonna act, like, I mean, so often in this type of movie, they could have just, there's so many times where a new actress would have just been his wife and, you know, she would have just been there and looked pretty and we wouldn't have batted an eye at it or whatever. But I think, like, the fact that she's coming back, it's like, I mean, yes, you want to give her something to do and, like, credit to them for giving her a little bit to do.
Yeah.
Which, in the 80s, I don't feel like they would have actually really cared most often. She could have just done it the other way, but. Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed like those scenes were the parts to me where the movie clearly started to drag. And then it was like, "Hey, back to the action, back to John McClane and all that stuff." And it wasn't like in the original, the first movie where she's like actually helping like keep people alive and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
With Home Alone, we said that the second one was far inferior to the first one, and you don't really think of them together. But these two, I like to think of as together because I think that they're equally strong. And part of it is because of the claustrophobic nature of them. Like, I like the fact that both of them involve someone that's kind of trapped somewhere. Whereas, like, once you get into the third, the fourth, the fifth, it's more of an open world video game. You know, you've got a lot more to work with. And so, I mean, that's one of the things that I like about this movie, though, is I like the airport aspect and everything like that.
I do feel like John McClane is more of a bumbling idiot in this movie than he is in the first Die Hard. Like, I felt like in the first Die Hard, he is clearly more of like a lethal weapon. And in this one, he's almost like just, he starts off like being all cool and like getting the guy to open the door and like, go get the police or whatever. But then it's like, he just immediately just finds himself almost on his heels.
Yeah.
Like he's getting shot at, you know, he's definitely not like a precision shot and or like the greatest fighter in any way.
Yeah.
Although he does have some pretty gruesome kills.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like, and he has that line about how he's like, I have to stop smoking.
Yeah.
As he's like running down these tunnels. Like, yeah, it just seems like he's less of a hero and more of a in the right place at the right time trying to get through it.
Well, see, and that is one of the things about the first movie is he's left alone. He gets to play, like, this sniper game, whereas in this one, he's always pushed aside by other people. And so I can understand why you feel that way, Colin. But, I mean, you know, he does get creative. I mean, he stabs the guy in the eye with the icicle at one point.
I did.
That was a good one.
I will give him kudos for that. I also really enjoyed when he is in like the baggage area when the guy's like looks up and he just sees McClane riding a bike towards him and like that bike takedown. That was
exactly
good.
Right. He knows that that's the better way to outrun someone. But I mean, on the other hand, he's also got moves like when he's rolling and shooting at the same time. That's one of those that just seems like a wild waste of bullets. That seems so impractical.
Like, honestly, that scene when they're in the place, the new tower, whatever that's
being the scaffold
painted,
area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The amount of bullet holes that are in the walls of that place is insane.
I know.
Like, I don't think he has a hit. I wouldn't be surprised if the two guys like just shot themselves.
Imagine the construction workers coming in just after they've taken their Christmas holidays. They come in on the 27th and they're just like, "What the fuck? Come on. We were almost done. we were down to painting. Now we have to fill in all these holes, replace the windows. Fuck."
I also could have sworn that one of those terrorists was Robert Patrick. T-1000? Yeah, okay, perfect.
Yep,
I was like, I think that's him. Yeah.
My uncle noticed that. He was like, "That's the guy from Terminator." And I was like, "I've never seen Terminator, so I wouldn't know."
Holy shit! Oh god, Jack! Oh, you hurt my heart!
Oh my gosh, Jack.
I haven't seen a lot of good movies. So I'll just there. There's your warning right now.
Oh boy!
Don't name them. I'll just keep saying no.
It's okay. I've been in your position.
I did read that one of the terrorists was going to be played by Billy Campbell, but when he got cast as the Rocketeer, he dropped out.
Hmm. Oh, I have seen the Rocketeer.
Oh well, there you go.
That's something, I guess. Come on, Jack. Haven't seen T2. What the fuck? Oh god. But yeah, that's Robert
Jack's
Patrick.
Jack's only seen Terminator Genesis. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. Terminator Dark Fate is pretty good. I'd recommend that one.
It wasn't too bad. Yeah, it course corrected.
I think all of my Terminator exposure came from when I was in Universal Studios, and they had some sort of promotional, like a ride or something.
Yeah, they've got the movie there. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit, as you know, some of the iconic stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you haven't lived, though, until you've seen the T2 show in Japanese.
So,
Yeah. I saw that one at Universal in Japan. So.
Yeah, the Spider-Man ride at Universal Japan, that one I have memories of. Because I went to Universal when I was 6 years old in Japan. Yeah. Okay. I have memories of Japanese Spider-Man landing on the foot of our car, talking in Japanese.
Nice.
Yeah.
As he does. We don't know what the multiverse is going to bring. I mean, we are recording this before the new Spider-Man has dropped, even though it's coming out after the new Spider-Man has dropped. But we'll see. We'll see how many of those rumors come out with that movie. But yeah, let's talk about the terrorists a little bit, because, I mean, we've got two different terrorist groups. So, Jack, as a first-time viewer of this movie, were you surprised with the, like, when you saw the red tape, blue tape?
I was immediately skeptical. I was like, oh, they did that on purpose. They said, we're putting in the blue bullets right as the friendlies, quote, are, like, on their way, like, are, like, the enemies are coming to attack our base.
Yeah, Major Grant's team, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, as a video game player, I've seen a lot of stuff, so, like, I was like, oh, okay, that seems really suspicious. I bet you they're firing blanks. And then when it came out, I was like, ah, I was correct. They were blanks, and I'm not crazy.
So did you make the connection between Colonel Stewart and Major Grant, like the two different teams having the taped clips?
I made the connection actually way before that scene. I was like, I was thinking that he was not going to be a good person when he was talking to McClane about how he had trained the
Colonel Stewart. Yeah.
Yeah. He had trained Stewart. And I was like, oh, if he's trained this other Colonel, like either he's like going to be a really helpful, like, oh, I know all of his moves, or they're working together. And then it turned out they were working together.
Yeah. 90s action movie. They're working together.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
I do love though, how he proves to Lorenzo that, like, that they're blanks. I've always loved
that. Oh God.
He pulls the gun on him and just starts firing. All the cops in the background with their bullets.
Can you imagine, like those cops would have definitely shot him. They would not have let him empty an entire clip of blanks into Lorenzo. Like, they would have immediately just taken him out. Like, if a man starts to fire a gun, like, at one of your people, you're just going to shoot him. Like,
yeah. But I will compliment the little bit of acting there from Dennis Franz when you see, like, it come over Lorenzo's face of, wait a minute, I'm not dead. Oh shit, he was right. Like, it's a setup. Like, you know, you can actually see all those thoughts come through his head.
Yeah, and gears are turning.
Yeah, so I mean, it is kind of a masterclass moment of acting right there, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good scene. I was not expecting that turn. And it actually kind of annoyed me when it happened, when he slits that guy's throat. I was like, ugh. It's just like,
I didn't understand why he slit the guy's throat, but I knew, like, is it because they were all talking about how they had, like, known each other before, and then
one of their guys got appendicitis.
Yeah, they were talking earlier about how they had to get one new replacement or whatever.
Right. And then he wasn't on the team, so then they had to kill him or whatever. I remember there was another scene when they were back at the airport where he was like, yeah, I'm the new guy. Remember that?
Yeah, when John is talking to him. Yeah, I mean, John happens to find the exact right person to be talking to because he's the only guy that actually isn't in on it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's getting accurate information.
You know what I loved was the code names they all had.
Well, one thing I found interesting was, like, you know, when this movie is edited for TV, one of the most famous ones that people are furious about is in this movie where he says, Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon.
Mr. Falcon.
Yeah. And for years, like, people are furious that, like, there is no Mr. Falcon in this movie. But that is General Esperanza's code name.
That's the code name, yeah.
Yeah.
And, so, like, we only know that because once he gets the radio, he can hear all the code names.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned in the first movie, like, this one at least has the keypad that they have to enter. So these radios are better than the ones in the first ones. But I think my favorite code name, though, is when they say, this is Buckwheat. The clubhouse is open when they take over the church.
That's a good one. That's like an iconic line. Like, that's like something you say with your friends when you're playing with walkie-talkies. Like,
yeah. So the only special effects in this movie, though, that I have to say that I really can't endorse is the cockpit ejection scene with the grenades. But I do love the, how many grenades do we have? 3 each. Use them all. But those are like the longest timers ever on a grenade.
Yeah. I noticed that and said it out loud. I was like, don't grenades have like a 6-second fuse on them? Like, yeah. I was like, they like land in the cockpit and he like looks at them and he's like, oh no. And then like, maybe like two or like, it feels like a 2 minutes or so go by before they explode.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but he's got enough time to look around, come up with a plan, buckle in, pull the thing, even though like the first grenades from each person have already been sitting on the floor of that for like 30 seconds. But yeah, just the when he's in the air, like I can't get behind that. That's way too blue screen. That's a special effect I've never liked and still don't like.
Yeah, that one was a little bit hard to watch.
Yeah,
the other effects that was a little like you could tell it was dated was the other planes when the reporter looks out the window off like across.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see the little plane, and it's, like, really, really shaky, like, going past. Like, you can tell it's, like, on a string or something.
Yeah.
And it just like, dates the practical effects, because that's a practical effect at that point. It's not a special effect.
Yeah, I like that moment, too. You're awfully close. So's that plane.
Like, it, like, jiggles by.
If you're going to be this close, could you possibly change your aftershave? Anything else? A breath mint? Oh. Like, there are great lines on the plane. Like, if anything, there's some great lines on the plane. I almost find this one more quotable than the first one, surprisingly enough. Even though the first one has things like, come out to the coast, have a good time, you know, things like that. But, yeah, there's some great lines in this movie.
Well, I even like when John gets to Esperanza's plane after it lands and he goes in and I can't even remember how it goes, but he's like, who are you? He's like, I'm a cop. He's like, I'm the good guy. You're the bad guy. It's, just like, it's just so black and white. That's like every little boy's dream, John McClane.
Why is the general allowed to wear his general uniform, though?
I said the same thing. It's like they didn't like put him in
a jumpsuit,
prison outfit or anything. They let him have a cigarette in his pocket, like, or a cigar. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I don't understand that either. Yeah, that guy should be in a jumpsuit.
And they only put one, the youngest military man they could, next to him on the plane, like one kid.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think there would be an escort of a few people. Yeah, absolutely. Unless everyone else was just sleeping.
It was kind of a badass mood on Esperanza's part when he kills that pilot, though, I must say.
Yeah.
Even though I feel like there has to be some sort of issues with the glass in a cockpit being broken right in front of where the pilot sits.
Yeah, that would be cold, for one.
That'd be a tough drive, I think. Just a massive jet stream coming right at your face.
I've lost cabin pressure. I'm bringing it into land.
Yeah, maybe I'll go into the co-pilot seat to land this plane, though. That might be a better idea. I mean, I've had cars before where, like, the window is broken and I have to drive around for a couple days in the winter with, like, a plastic bag on the window, and that's freezing. I can't imagine winter time with plane speeds. I did read, though, that snow was very hard to come by in this movie because every location that they wanted to film in was unseasonably warm that year. And so every time they'd show up to film something, like, the snow was melting. And so they actually had to ship in snow from Canada. It's like, go Canada, bring in the snow.
They should have just came to Edmonton. I feel like there's no way in 1990 the Edmonton airport was not cold.
Yeah, covered in snow pretty much year-round.
Yeah. Well, you know that one scene where he goes up the ladder. I mean, first of all, how cold would that ladder be as well?
Oh, but wait, your hands would have been sticking to it.
Yeah, when he's pushing his way out of the grate, that scene was filmed in 8 different locations.
What?
No.
Yeah, because like the shot of the general in the cockpit was one location. you know, the runway was another location. Like, having it come in was a third location.
You know, like, wow. It just...
Yeah, they had to get these shots in, but I don't know why. But yeah, that one shot, like that 2 minutes of film, is eight different locations. And it's like, wow, that shows you kind of how odd the movie industry is to work in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's all like, I guess, like forced, like kind of spatial awareness, maybe, because it's when you want things to seem bigger, like longer than they are. And it's like, you just, or maybe they just wanted like really specific looks. For each portion of the shot or whatever, but yeah, that's cool. I think the one thing this movie really lacks is, like, in Die Hard, you have, it's almost like there's a tête-à-tête between Hans Gruber and John McClane happening.
Yeah.
But
you never get that in this movie. I felt like that was what was really missing. Like, I think that Colonel Stewart could have been a good villain, and like he has like his moment at the end, but because they've never had, like, a lot of interaction beforehand, it doesn't... It's not as climactic as I feel like I wanted it to be, like, when he goes face-to-face with Hans.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because there's the one moment where he's like, you know, damn it, Stuart, you've made your point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only interaction he has, and he wasn't even supposed to be on that phone call.
Yeah, it almost seems like Trudeau has more of that interaction with Stewart than anyone
he
else.
He does.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones talking back and forth over the radio.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. That's true. That it is better to build that relationship between the adversaries. Like it would have given more impact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do also think that, kind of like you were saying, like, I do like how you said claustrophobic, like how contained this movie is.
Yeah,
but I did like the aspect of Die Hard where it's just one man alone,
yeah,
kind of like against the world. Whereas in Die Hard 2, I feel like he just spends half the movie like really trying to appeal to everybody to get them to help him and like realize what's going on, which doesn't seem like a very John McClane thing to do, in my opinion. I kind of feel like he's more of the guy like who's just figuring it out on his own and like has almost that element of surprise aspect that he had in the first movie where that's kind of the edge that he has in the whole first movie, right? It's like they don't know where he is. They know he's there, but they don't know where he is. And so he kind of has the upper hand in that. Whereas in this one, John's kind of like on his heels in every way. Like the terrorists really don't care about him at all. They're going to do whatever. They're going to do whatever they want to do. He's just trying to get in the way.
Yeah. No, yeah, he thinks he's right, but, like, there's just too many people in his way. Like, in the first one, the FBI tell him to stand down, and it's like, well, fuck, what are they going to do? Yeah.
Yeah, they can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm surprised that they didn't just throw him in the prison at one point. Like, it's like, yeah, there's got to be an airport jail.
Yeah. You
know? I don't know. Yeah. No, that's a solid point. Oh, man, that fight on the wing of the plane, though. Towards the end,
still awesome.
Love it, love it. But you know, I do like how he, you know, like, well, John McClane knows that he can stuff a coat in the flap, and it's gonna stop the plane. That's
yeah. It's very convenient that the flap went up, right? Because they need them to go down to get the plane in the air, and that it like went up, and then he was like, oh god, well it's still up, quick. Shove my coat in there so it can't go down so that they can't take off.
Well, okay, that is a good question. Like, when a plane is about to take off, is it up to keep it like against the ground like that, or would it just be level?
It'd be level because it's like the airfoil, it has to be the curve and then it's straight. If it's up, that's like a break. It's
so the end when you're landing, the flaps go up.
Okay. So that is a good question then of why that flap was up. That's something I never even thought of.
Especially since Esperanza is like supposed to be a pro pilot.
Like he's like he landed his other plane perfectly and like
I mean, I do kind of love that end scene where it's like all the guys are just in the back hangar of that jet just preparing to go to their tropical paradise.
They're like get about to get paid, like they got like they're breaking out the like champagne on the plane, like chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess one thing we haven't touched on is snowmobile chase as well. Oh yeah, I mean, even that whole action scene, even though like a lot of it is just for show, like it is a pretty great action scene. The taking of the church and then the snowmobile scene and you know things like that.
It was the jump over the truck at the end with the explosion was cool.
Yeah.
I just found it so funny that literally, like, what was that last snowmobile guy thinking, just stopping and looking back? Like, why would you do that? You're trained military, forward always. Like, but it's literally just so he can get shot and John can steal the snowmobile. But I thought that's funny. It's like that's what you get for hesitating.
I love that they at the beginning of the movie. You can see a few times where they like check their ammo and like reload their guns.
Yeah.
I think over the course of the movie, I think I saw 4 reloads.
Yeah. That
maybe a couple thousand bullets and 4 reloads.
That is a very good point that I was going to say. Yeah, it's one thing with the soldiers and their machine guns cuz they're just like spraying clips left and right. But like, and I think we've had to talk about this with other movies, but I'm pretty sure, like, the average... I'm just going to Google it.
I think it's, like, 9 bullets.
Yeah, like, I think it's 9 or, like, 15 bullets maybe in a magazine, like a police-issued magazine.
Yeah.
But I never see where John... There's no way he could have enough ammo. And it's not like he's not picking up other people's guns. He does occasionally when he gets a machine gun, but he's...
I think he switches pistols one time, too.
Is he? Okay. Because I was watching the same thing, and I was like, where is he... Like, where is he holding this ammunition? Like, was he expecting to be in a gunfight today? Yeah. Like
he brought with him to the airport to pick up his wife, like, maybe a couple, like, 4 or 5 magazines. Just because. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you'd think that he'd be like, man, a ceramic Glock. I'm just going to keep this. Shit. Yeah. This is a nice gun.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's worth that much.
He's like, I'll just take this and then sell it later. Like,
yeah, pretty much.
I thought it was cool the like taped magazines because I've seen that in games where it's like a fast reload. Is you just pull out one side, flip it over, put it in the other side, and I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think it might have been just a reason to be able to do red tape, blue tape. However, it was still interesting to me.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was gonna say, even though we're at kind of the end of the show, one of my favorite moments of this movie. For whatever reason, I don't know why, I was like, you don't see this in movies anymore, but I love it when the 3 terrorists are sitting at the table and they take the time to synchronize their watches.
Yeah.
It's just like such an old school spy, like, heist thing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Now everyone has digital watches that are like run by Bluetooth on a million different Wi-Fi things.
Yeah. Yeah, now the only time that I know is actually accurate is when I look at my phone.
Yeah.
But that's okay because that is the only clock I use these days. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always hate it when like my stove clock is, you know, 5 minutes fast and my microwave clock is 3 minutes slow and
I say the end, like the movie ends, right? And you get that, oh, everything is good now. But like she like takes the time as she's getting out of the plane to like stop everybody behind her and like wait for so like she's like listening and then she's like, there he is, my husband, and then she like dramatically jumps out of the plane. Like they would have been behind her just like shoving her down the ramp.
Yeah.
Like
come on, yeah. Yeah. I also want to know like how they got Thornburg out. Like did they just drag his body over and throw it down?
Well, I think they, because there's a part where you see them like carrying him back to his seat after he's been tased.
Oh yeah, that's
I think he might have come to a little bit and then he.
Okay.
Well, yeah, like because at the end he's just like lying in the snow. They show a shot of him just lying in the snow, so it's like he can't get up out of the snow. How did he get out of the plane? Like it just.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Uncle Phil was on the plane and just launched him out.
Yeah. But, you know, just like the other movie, this one ends with him getting a ride away from all the ambulances and fire trucks and everything like that. You got to love how he gets a golf cart in this one or whatever it is, but, you know, even though he got a limo in the first one, but
Nice and bloody for those golf for the final drive away.
Yeah, But the McLeans live another day and they drive off into the sunset. And the end. That is Die Hard 2, Die Harder. Oh boy. So Colin, Jack, on IMDb, it scored 7.1 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 67. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 69% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 70%. But Colin, those are just numbers. Like an icicle to the eye. Hit us with some reviews.
I'm going to start. It's been a while since I went to my man, Roger Ebert. Okay. But I'm going to start with the Roger Ebert review.
He says,
"Whatever small pleasure there is to be found in this loud dud is due mostly to the residual good feelings from the first film. As played by Bruce Willis, McLean is still an engaging character, even if he is much less amusingly drawn this time. Willis is in there trying, but the qualities that helped to make his character sympathetic in the first film are missing. McLean no longer worries openly about his personal safety as he did in the original movie. His quasi-cowboy personality from Die Hard is all but forgotten. He has become more of a Rambo and less of a Roy Rogers. And though the filmmakers tried to establish McLean as resistant to advanced technology, this promising idea isn't developed." Which is very true. He keeps making these like technological jokes, but there's no payoff to that.
No.
Like it never comes into play. It's just like a funny joke that they keep making.
Well, yeah, I mean, even with the fax machine where he's like, "I've circled the worlds just in case they didn't come through in the transmission." And it's like, well, would you still be able to actually compare the prints to anything?
Yeah.
If you've drawn a line through part of the fingerprint?
Yeah, exactly.
Now we'll go to the people. Waleed A gives the movie 2 out of 5 stars and says, "Lots of dumb stuff, lots of old movie qualities, bad story, bad villain, some pretty good action, but this movie seems to think lots of shooting equals good action. Useless side plots." And then this is one of my favorite things I've ever seen in a review. He puts in brackets about 3 viewings. So just so you know, it's like his review is only based on 3 watches, so that,
okay,
you know, he leaves open the potential that maybe if you watched it more often, you might like it.
you might like it more.
That's very considerate. Yeah. I have to say.
Yeah. Jake E. gives the movie 4 out of 5 stars and says, "Die Hard 2 is a decent sequel to an already great movie, but lives in the shadow of the previous film, much like Home Alone 2. And then a bracket says, "I mean, that is a pretty hard standard to live up to. It's almost similar to the first film about a police officer at Christmas time being at the wrong place at the wrong time, but the stakes are considerably higher as John McClane is out to foil a terrorist plot in an airport and help safely land a plane, saving the lives of passengers. Despite a few flaws with the plot and characters, Die Hard 2 is still pretty enjoyable and fun to watch around the holidays as much as the first film. That said, though, Merry Christmas, and I hope you enjoy this movie as much as I did."
Man, like so much positive cheer in the end of that review there.
Well, here we go.
Whatever you think, at least Merry Christmas.
Paul A. gives the movie 2 out of 5 stars and says, "It's okay, but my God, does it ever come across as a made-for-TV movie. It's incredibly weak compared to the movies that came before and after."
Oh, well, I agree with the "and after." I mean, I do like 3, like I said, but 4 and 5, it starts to go off the rails a little bit.
And then the last review I have is from Kyle P., 3 out of 5 stars. "It's a little strange that Die Hard 2 chose to take place on Christmas Eve again, but I'll take it. This movie was set up to fail after the massive success of the first film, and although it's not as good, I still find myself enjoying myself watching it. I think it's aged the worst out of the 3 originals, and the plot is kind of forgettable, but what saves it from going down is Bruce Willis's performance of John McClane. Most of the plot I like. There's one part towards the end that I don't think I fully understand, but whatever. Overall, I'll watch this movie every time I want to watch the franchise, but it's really just a movie that sits on my shelf that I enjoy watching, but not a lot." For that...
In brackets, 3 times.
Yeah. For that, I give Die Hard 2 3 stars.
Nice. I want to know what part at the end he's talking about.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Like, I'm trying to think of what part at the end could be confusing.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess if he listens to the show, maybe hit us up and let us know specifically what you're talking about.
Yeah.
What was he confused about when Major Grant's team decided to turn? Like, the plot twist? Wait a minute, they were in on it? I don't understand. Why are they in on it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, like I said, 7.1 out of 10 and 67 on IMDb, 69 and 70. So everything just floating around 70% overall with ratings. Jack, it is your first viewing of this movie. We made you watch Die Hard 1. We've now made you watch Die Hard 2, Die Harder. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it, actually. It was fun. A friend asked me after I had finished watching what I thought, and I said, it was really fun. It had that nostalgia factor because it's an old movie. And like, it was sort of like, I would say it was sort of dumb fun, right?
Okay.
Like the explosions and the CG was bad, but it doesn't matter because you're not watching it. You're not watching it to watch an action movie as you would be now. You're watching it because it's an old movie that you enjoy. And that's what I found with it, is that like, it was fun. It was funny at times. It had all that like sort of power and like, I want to say like rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a, like the whole time.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. Yeah. If I was going to give it like a number out of 10, I'd give it probably like a 7.5, like an 8.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like it wasn't my favorite movie of all time, but I definitely would watch it again.
Yeah. And like the first, like solidly a Christmas movie, you'd say, right?
Oh, most definitely a Christmas movie.
Most definitely a Christmas movie. Right on. Colin, what about you on this viewing of Die Hard 2, Die Harder? What did you think?
Okay, guys, I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I think I have a really interesting take on this movie, so
buckle up.
So, going into this movie, I like really didn't want to watch it, because I remember watching it, like I said, when I binge-watched the trilogy 10 or so years ago.
Definitely,
and I remember thinking that Die Hard 2 was like a steaming load of shit. I remember thinking it was just like one of the worst movies I'd ever watched.
Mm-hmm.
And now I watched it, and I'm totally on board with everything that Jack just said. Like, I think it's just a fun, dumb action movie.
Yeah.
And I would watch it again. But the caveat that I would say with that is, like, unlike most film franchises, which I think are meant to be kind of watched in sequence and watched back to back. Like, you know, like anytime you watch Star Wars, you probably start at the beginning and you watch it all.
Yeah.
Or at least trilogy wise, maybe you don't watch like the entire, like seven, whatever.
Nine.
You don't watch the entire
nine. And
nine
and a half. If you include Rogue One as well.
Or yeah. Solo, you don't,
10,
yeah. You don't
movies?
Watch, yeah. You don't, you would watch like you watch them in their sets, but you watch them all at once. You're like Harry Potter, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Batman, even like you watch them all at once. I would say with Die Hard, I would caution people to not watch Die Hard before you watch Die Hard 2. I think that you should watch Die Hard like we did last year. Give it space, like cycle it yearly by movie. Like, Die Hard, I don't think is meant to be watched all at once. Die Hard is like a slow meal. Like, you just watch one at a time with a year in between each one, and I bet they're all enjoyable. But you can't. The thing is, Die Hard is amazing. The first movie is so good. It's very original. Very like
absolutely.
Very good. But Die Hard 2, I would say, is almost a parody of Die Hard. If you watch Die Hard 2 right after you watch Die Hard, it's the exact same premise, but done worse. So you can't have Die Hard right fresh. You can't have Die Hard just fresh in your brain and then go into Die Hard 2, because Die Hard 2 just cannot live up to it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
Like it lacks the good villain. It lacks the like one man army, like the one man alone against the odds.
Yeah.
And just the B plot is kind of fluffy. Like everything about it is lesser. So I would just say, if you're going to watch Die Hard 2, make sure that you've given a lot of space from Die Hard.
A short enough time that Die Hard is still fresh in your mind.
Yeah.
But a long enough time that you can appreciate this as its own movie. Okay, I get that. I get where you're going with that. I totally see that. I mean, I said earlier that absolutely, like, I feel like this one and the first one are equal, but Yeah, I guess you've convinced me a little bit that, yes, now I see what's missing in this movie. Like, just in your little talk right there just now, yes, I see the few things that are missing in this movie that, you're right, it is a bit of a parody of a Die Hard movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I echo both of you. I mean, I still love this movie. It's,
yeah.
It's a fun, good time. And as a Die Hard movie, it's a good one. It's top three, that's for sure. You know?
Yeah. Like, I was glad to have had this opportunity to rewatch it because, like I said, I'd had a bad taste in my mouth about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a while. And watching it now, I do, like, I agree with you both. Like, I think it is a fun watch. Like, it's just a fun, it's like a fun, I think it's a fun movie to probably, like, watch with your buddies or watch with your uncles like Jack did.
Yeah. Well, I will say then, though, if you think that this movie is a parody of a Die Hard movie, you better not watch 4 and 5.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll get to them, like, next year I'll watch 3.
Yeah.
And then the year after, you know, it needs space. It needs to breathe. You need to let Die Hard breathe a little bit.
Well, you know, with the theory that I had at the beginning, I'll put it this way. 4 and 5, it's shaved head Bruce Willis.
Yeah, okay.
Well, there we go. That is Die Hard 2, Die Harder. And that's our show for this week. Oh, boy. A big, huge thank you to our man, Jack Bazook, coming back, reprising his role as John McClane on another Christmas episode for us. I forget from last year. Do you
like promoting anything?
I got nothing to promote right now. I'm just in university, but my Instagram is Jack_Bazook. That's BIZUK. And that's pretty much where you can find me.
If you want to see pictures of him at school.
Yeah, I'm in engineering.
Do you have videos of you like throwing girls in the air and stuff?
Yeah, I do actually. I have my cheerleading stuff on there, which is really neat.
There you go. Go see Jack doing some impressive physical feats.
Yeah. Plus, if anybody's looking for a dancer for their cruise lines, then you know Jack's your man.
Yeah.
But thank you for joining us once again, Jack. This was a lot of fun, and we'll have to figure out a way to get you in for Die Hard 3 next year. Either we do it just before December, or we just throw the Christmas movie idea out the window just for one of the weeks. I don't know.
I mean, I say, why wait for Die Hard 3? We need to get Jack in for Terminator, because, I mean, that's just something
yes.
I cannot abide.
I think so, yeah. We might have to have him back sooner than Christmas. If you like that show, oh boy, you know what you should do? If you are looking for a last-minute Christmas present to give someone, well, tell them about this show if they're a movie lover. That's the gift that keeps on giving. And guess what, folks? It's free. Just tell people. And they can go and download this show themselves. Or if you want to go above and beyond and give us a Christmas present this Christmas season, well, why not just go over to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars? Give us a review. It doesn't matter what you say. We love words of affirmation, but it's not for our egos otherwise, though. So just go on there, give us a review. 5 stars just helps drive us up the charts, helps us get noticed. Or if you want to go above and beyond and help us out, go over to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and donate a couple bucks. Throw a couple bucks our way. Help us with our Christmas shopping. Become part of our Patreon family, and you even get a shout out on our show, just like executive producer Joshua Blum.
And be sure to check out our website, www.IUsedToLikeThisOne.com. You can find links to all of our podcast episodes, information, social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that good stuff. Send us an email if you want at IUsedToLikeThisOne@gmail.com and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe we'll talk about them on the show.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter and the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One. And Merry Christmas. Happy Holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy Festivus. all those good stuff from us at I Used to Like This One. Nice.
Nice.